Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. It is Monday morning, January the 24th, 2022. First thing, 8:30 in the morning. And to me, that has come to mean my weekly conversation with Jimmy Sexton in Dubai, founder of the Esquire Group, where we are gradually working our way through a discussion of all of the tremendous lessons in Charles Adams' great book, For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. Welcome, Jimmy. How are you today?
I'm fantastic, John. It was great to see you again. I always look forward to Mondays, which is not something that I did before we started this endeavor.
This is a great way to get to start the week. There's no question about it. Well, here we are. We're actually at lesson 10. I think I'm going to begin by reading this slowly. There's so much in this.
It's a big lesson.
And sort of unpeeling it. I mean, what I'm about to read, I think, makes just so much sense to the average person that they say, why are you even reading something that is so obviously true? But yet, this particular principle is more common, I think, in its breach. But here we go. Tax exemptions are inherently unjust unless they actually apply to everyone. If the constitutional principle of equality before the law is ever applied to taxation, then those in control of tax making must bear the same taxes those on the outside. Whoa, what a concept. This means that in an aristocracy or oligarchy, the few would have to bear the same taxes as the many. And in a democracy, the many should bear the same taxes as the few. Well, just as a bit of an aside, before we get into the meat of this, these first world countries, I was going to say democracies, are they actually democracies or are they oligarchies? I mean, you know, it's getting harder to tell the difference, isn't it?
I would say for purposes of this lesson, it is a democracy. But I would say that they operate more as totalitarian states at this point, in my view. But I think in terms of taxation, if you're reading Charles Adams's book, I would say for purposes of this lesson, we would call the first world countries democracies.
All right. So what Mr. Adams then is saying that in a democracy, meaning Canada, the United States, Australia, Germany, blah, 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 the many should bear the same taxes as the few. Well, you know, the few in America, actually, the really wealthy people, they don't really pay that much in taxes, do they?
Well, I mean, before we get into the real wealthy not paying taxes, let's start with the fact that 56% of the U.S. population didn't pay any income taxes in 2020.
You mean federal?
Federal income tax, right? So you had the entirety of the federal income tax that was paid for 2020 fell on 44% of the population. And that 44% is hardly the ultra wealthy, right? I mean, we can just call those, income earners. And I mean, even if you're making $100,000, which doesn't go that far in the United States anymore, you're paying a significant amount of income tax. So I think that is a big problem, right? Especially when you have the 56% who don't pay any tax, have the same voting rights as the 44% that are paying. So you have 100% of the people voting on how to spend the money, but you only have a minority, the 44%, that are paying for it. And that seems kind of ridiculous, because if I'm not paying taxes, well, then I'm going to vote for a bunch of spending that other people are going to pay for.
Well, that's exactly right. As I've been saying for years, in the Western world, it's reached the point where more people vote for a living than work for a living. You would agree with that?
It's absolutely true. And I think I think that, you know, I think as a concept, when you think, when you go back to the beginning of this and it says tax exemptions are inherently unjust unless they actually apply to everyone, right? And when you start thinking about child tax credits, when you start thinking about all of these different exemptions that exist for lower income taxpayers that get phased out as your income goes up, it's inherently unjust, right? Because you have people that are getting that are benefiting more from the government without paying anything, and that's just not right.
Well, wouldn't a possible solution to this be to promote and rely much more, actually in some cases create sales taxes, right? Value added tax, etc. It seems to me that that kind of tax ensures that at least everybody pays some tax, right?
Well, I think that a sales tax system is a good system. And it will fall more on the wealthy. The wealthy will pay a lot more in sales tax because they spend a lot more. But everybody will have skin in the game. And that's what important is, right? Right? I mean, people don't value what they haven't sacrificed for. And so if you don't have any skin in the game, what do you care what the government does with the money? You're not paying for it anyway. So I think a sales tax or a flat tax with no exemptions. You pay 10% of your income. If you make 30 grand, you pay 3,000. If you make 3 billion, you pay 300 million.
All right. Now that's an interesting concept. And I've thought about that from time to time over the years. A sales tax, conceptually, we all understand it's just something, you know, slapped on the cash register, you know, what have you. I do not understand why the United States has not moved to a value-added tax, or at least incorporated into what they're doing. But they haven't, and there doesn't seem to be any reasonable possibility of that. But the second thing you're proposing, and this is very interesting, is a revenue tax, right? Not a profit tax. And one of the attractive features to that is that, you know, it puts an end to all this ridiculous bookkeeping, you know, compliance nonsense, et cetera, because basically, you know, if somebody pays Jimmy Sexton, what are you currently charging, $10 million a client or something?
At least. I'm planning on going up to 12 and a half.
Sorry, I didn't mean to undershoot the mark there. Okay. And then, you know, they say, all right, Jimmy, you know, you just got $10 million for this client. You know, you have to send 5% of that. And that, I think, has a certain logic to it. I don't really buy into the argument that it should only be profits that are taxed, because, I mean, if you can't afford the 5%, you probably shouldn't be in that business anyway. Would you agree?
100%.
So that's, you know, that's I think a possible way of doing it as well. And
well, and I think look, if you want to make a tax system fair, right? I think profits are very, I think they're a little bit of a minefield because profits are so subjective, right? I mean, what is a business expense? What's a personal expense? I mean, there's a lot of things that get sort of intertwined.
Depreciation.
There.
You know, I mean, it goes on and on and on.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, there really is a significant built-in extra compliance cost to a system that taxes profits as opposed to revenue, isn't there? You know, because you need this whole army of, CPAs, tax specialists, et cetera.
Well, I think not just that, but you also sort of, probably are going to remove a lot of the fear that citizens have of the IRS, right? Because most of the anxiety that people have with audits from the IRS is that the IRS is going to disallow deductions, right? I mean, revenue is fairly easily tracked, right? I mean, if you get audited, they're going to look at your bank account. They're going to add everything up. You know, they get reporting on credit card payments. It's not so easy to to sort of cheat on revenue, right? I mean,
actually, I think it's practically impossible now. Yeah, because, you know, but cash pays out.
Exactly. So the only place you can really sort of have any wiggle room is on the deductions. And this is where everybody has anxiety that, you know, even if they take what they believe is a legitimate deduction, the IRS is going to take a contrary view if they're audited. And I mean, Americans, I did a post that I'm going to do on LinkedIn. I think it's going to publish on LinkedIn in a couple of days, which, you know what? When I was a US citizen, I never realized how much anxiety and fear was constantly hanging over my head from the IRS. And not that I was doing anything wrong, but right, every time I paid for something, am I paying for this out of the right bank account? Am I charging it to the right credit card? Don't forget to keep this receipt and give it, you know, to my accountant. Is this deduction going to be reasonable? Is the IRS going to challenge this? Is this a business expense, a personal expense? You're constantly analyzing the tax impact of every single decision in your life. And if you have a flat tax with no deductions, you get rid of that anxiety for people. You give them a better life.
I think that is absolutely right. And, you know, an interesting example, you know, just recently in my own life was working with somebody on an expatriation. As you know, if people collapse their U.S. retirement plans before, 59 and a half, there's a 10% penalty, you know. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, I mean, obviously neither you nor I are in favor of erosion of capital. But what she said to me was, you know what, I don't really care. I don't want anything more to do with this period. I'm collapsing this now and that's it. I want to move forward in life, you know, without having to think about this. And, that is really a clear expression of the psychic cost of this kind of problem. That is so extraordinary. Now, you know, one of the things I think when you look at the issue of equality in a tax system, you know, since we're into the psychic cost of this stuff and the anxiety, and everybody feels this, everybody feels this anxiety, is when you look at the discrepancy in the different tax systems the U.S. has, the one for U.S. citizens, residents, and the one for Americans abroad who live in, Americans abroad just live in a constant state of anxiety, you know, partly because everything they have is foreign and nobody knows how to really deal with it, right?
Well, and I mean, and also when you talk about the psychological cost, the penalties are astronomical. Right. I mean, most of the Americans abroad that I know, I mean, their primary motivation for expatriation is not actually saving tax dollars. It's to get rid of the fear of being audited and the cost associated with fighting an IRS audit and the astronomical penalties that will get assessed regardless of what their intents were. I mean, look, most Americans abroad I know are law-abiding citizens that are doing their level best to comply with the tax code, and they're scared to death because the IRS is going to use Gestapo tactics to try to extract tax out of them, whether they owe it or not.
Well, I think that's right. And another way of putting it, although it is hard to generalize, but I think that it is generally true that people are renouncing U.S. citizenship precisely because they want to be in compliance and find it too difficult to do so.
I would agree, for sure.
You know, going back to this idea of a revenue tax versus a profit tax, I want to run a few things by you here.
Yep.
One is, you know, I think everybody says, but few understand. So everybody says, well, only the United States and Eritrea have citizenship taxation. Okay, so they say it. But what they don't understand is that the Eritrean model of citizenship taxation is sort of a revenue tax, you know, in the same way of what we're talking about. And of course, you and I both know what the U.S. system of citizenship taxation is, right? It's anything but, right? It's a whole sort of, you know, collection of rules for life control, taxes, forms, penalties, interest on fake income, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And the U.S. has the muscle to enforce it.
They have the muscle to enforce it more than any other country, but more to the point, there's a perception that they do, you know, which probably amounts to the same thing. But if we compare the Eritrean system of citizenship taxation to the U.S., you know, which is a revenue-based thing, to the U.S., which is this sort of profit and, you know, a whole internal revenue code-based thing, it seems to me that Americans abroad would be much better off under an Eritrea-based system of citizenship taxation, don't you think?
I do. And look, I mean, maybe one thing that you do, because, I mean, I think taxation in general, right? I mean, I think we can all agree that in order for a society to function and be governed and for a government to be able to provide protection for its citizens and a justice system and all this stuff, there needs to be taxes, right? For it to run.
Yeah, I don't think taxation is going away anytime soon.
No, and I think it's you know, to a certain degree it's needed. But here's the thing, you're supposed to pay taxes for the services you get from the government, right? So with citizenship-based taxation, American expat is really getting far less services than an American in America, right? I mean, basically the only thing they get is access to the embassies and, you know, possibly some protection if they're stranded somewhere. So if anything, they should pay a reduced amount of tax for the reduced services they get.
What would you think about this, okay? You know, I'm thinking about, let's assume that citizenship taxation continues for a minute without getting the merits of that.
Yeah.
But let's agree that there might be different ways of incorporating, you know, of running a citizenship taxation system. So I mean, I think that you and I both agree that if it were an Eritrea revenue-based system, that would probably be better. What about just poll tax? You know, you're a U.S. citizen, you owe us $500 a year or something. What about that?
I mean, listen, I think that's fantastic. I mean, yeah. Look, I think it's
less than you'd pay an accountant, right? It's less than you'd pay an accountant.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think, in general, I think this is the way government should work, right? I mean, I think that the problem is governments come up with their spending packages. I think citizens need to decide this is what government, you know, this is what government is supposed to provide. Protections for the citizens, you know, a judicial system, some infrastructure. It's going to cost X. Everybody needs to pony up this much.
Okay. You know, I mean, I think there's a certain logic to that. But of course, what has happened with tax policy? And I think we see this right from its inception, where in the beginning, tax obligations were based on levels of income that few people had. So part of the assumption of this seems to be that those who can't afford to pay more should pay more. What are your thoughts on that? Those who can't afford to pay more should pay more.
Well, I mean, look, I think in general, those that can afford to pay more should pay more. I think in general is okay, as long as everybody's paying something and the system is applying equally to everybody. Like in the case of a flat revenue tax, for example. But maybe you look at capping taxes, right? Where you say, look, you pay 10% up to, you know, $1 million in tax. And once you've paid $1 million, you know, you're done. Because governments aren't supposed to have these unlimited budgets. Governments are supposed to be moderate and provide limited services, and that's all that should be financed. And they don't need 10% of everything to finance that.
Right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. So, I mean, let's keep track of where we are in this discussion, which is quite interesting. One, if everybody should pay tax, then there should be a sales tax, right?
I think it's a good
one. Okay. Two, the issue of taxation on calculating profits and that probably be should be reconsidered. Why not just consider a revenue tax? You know, probably a flat rate, you know, whether it's 5%, 10% or whatever. You know, I think everybody would be further ahead. I think governments would clearly be further ahead. I think taxpayers would be further ahead, you know, because of the cost of compliance. Three, a possible poll. When we look at Americans abroad, then, you know, we sort of break it down to that. Yeah. You know, the Eritrean system is far more humane and just than the U.S. system, simply because it is a revenue tax. You know, failing that, you know, perhaps a poll tax, you know, a passport fee or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what else? This is going to be highly unpopular, but, you know, so I think if I think it's fair that everybody pays tax, because I don't think that people who don't pay tax should have a right to vote, at least not on spending.
Well, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, I do not know where countries are generally on that. Now, when you look at municipal...
Everybody gets to vote.
Well, let's you know, that may be on a national level, but let's look at municipal taxation as an example. In Toronto, where I live, the whole city, which is a large city with its huge bureaucracy, is basically funded from property taxes, right? So, you know, we have a system where, you know, let's say half the property in Toronto is rental property, right? So we have property owners financing the whole system for those who are not owners as well, right? And it seems to me that this is, you know, a bit of what you're talking about, right? And that the people who are not ultimately paying for this, you know, are able to vote. So, you know, you get a bunch of people who pay no property tax in the city of Toronto, you know, being essentially in a position where they can dictate where the revenues that are being extracted from the property owners are spent, right?
And I mean, but this is where it gets really sticky, right? Because if you only allow taxpayers to vote, then you have the possibility that those who are voting are going to somehow exploit those who aren't, which is kind of the opposite of what we have now, right? Those that are voting but not paying taxes are exploiting the minority that's paying the tax.
Right.
The only way to solve this is to have some sort of minimum amount of tax, whether that's a poll tax or something, where everybody has skin in the game. Because that way they know, listen, these extra services are going to cost more money and I'm eventually going to have to pay for that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I agree with you that it doesn't make long run a system where only a certain percentage of the people, whether it's 45 or 50 or whatever, are financing the cost of government. You know, that is completely unsustainable. And it's completely unjust. But let me ask you another question here. So when we look at Mr. Adams 10, tax exemptions are inherently unjust. Now, I think what you're saying, and if so, I would agree with you, that when people don't pay tax under the operation of laws, these are exemptions, agreed?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So are inherently unjust unless they apply equally to everyone. So everybody pays or nobody pays. Then it says, if the constitutional principle of equality before the law is ever applied to taxation. Now, let's focus on that part of it for a moment. One of the problems here is that, at least in the United States, and I think Canada, it's not like these countries are hugely different, by the way, okay, when it comes to taxation. I don't want to seem like I'm always picking on the United States. There doesn't seem to be any real sense that tax policy decisions are sort of governed by constitutional norms of equality before the law. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I absolutely agree that they're not. I mean, yeah. it's I mean, you know, the rights that a tax collector has over any other debt collector, for example, I mean, is way out of line.
Well, as I've said a million times on these podcasts, and it's a good opportunity to say it again, I mean, I think the Internal Revenue Code is now the Constitution of the United States.
For sure.
You know, ideas of equality before the law are, well, of course, subject to the tax laws. Well,
and look what happens, right? Anytime anybody wants to challenge it, whether it's in the Supreme Court or Congress, the IRS goes after them. Everybody's scared to death. Nobody can challenge the IRS. The only thing they can kind of do is not fund them, right? Which is what they've been able to do. They've kind of not funded them, which is different than attacking them and trying to take their curb their powers and stuff like that. But everybody's scared to death to challenge them.
Well, I think that's right. Well, that's clearly right. So let me ask you this. Let's imagine a world for a moment. We'll permit our imaginations to run wild here, Jimmy. Let's imagine a world where tax system and tax laws had to be subject to basic constitutional standards, be they human rights or whatever. And sometime when I was in law school, way back in the day, I remember taking some sort of class that had to do with equality or equal protection. And there's obviously a discussion of what that meant. And I remember at the time, the suggestion that equal protection required that people subject to laws had the equal care and concern of legislatures, not necessarily the same outcome, but the same care and concern. I would interpret that to mean that, you know, when you pass a law, you should be asking, who does this impact and why? Does that make sense?
Yep.
So in the case of Americans abroad, it's much more than out of sight, out of mind. It's that they clearly don't care about Americans abroad, but it's even worse, is that they don't care that they don't care. Do you think that they don't care that they don't care is in and of itself a violation of a principle of equality before the law?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think it's definitely a failure. The problem I think with the Americans abroad, right, is their voting is all scattered. The Americans abroad have they're really their own voting group, right? I mean, they should be able to vote like the 51st state, right? The Americans abroad, because right now their votes are scattered throughout the country and really have no impact. And there's such a minority in every place where they vote, in every state where they vote, that they can't have any impact. I mean, they're really sort of deserve their own representative in government, right? Because they're not represented in any real way.
Oh, I think that's clearly right. What I don't know is how that would mesh with the way government works in the United States. You know, the Constitution.
It would not.
So, in other words, if you're an American citizen who lives outside of the United States, you're basically agreeing that you have no political representation.
I'll give you one even worse. You're not even agreeing with it. You're just dealing with it because you don't have any choice other than to expatriate, which might not even be an option for you if you don't have a second citizenship.
Well, you know, as I've said repeatedly, Jimmy, there's two kinds of Americans who need a second citizenship. The first are those who live outside the United States, and the second are those who live inside the United States. As we spoke about last week, it's becoming increasingly important for American citizens to protect their right to not be American citizens, I think. I mean, this is really, really out of hand. There's no question about it.
And, you know, I've never thought of this, John. I mean, it's a little off topic, but I think it's an interesting maybe, well, I think it's an interesting insight. You know, one of the things that I love about living in Dubai, and I don't think anybody can argue with this, the United States is, you know, I think Americans are so innovative and they have such a can-do positive attitude. Like when you have, I remember when I lived in the US, like when you have a business idea, everybody rallies around you. How can I help? How can we make this? They introduce connections. They do whatever they can to help each other succeed. And I think that's part of the reason why America is such an economic powerhouse is there's a very can-do attitude and everything moves very, very quickly compared to everywhere else in the world. And relatively cost-effectively too, like setting up companies and all this kind of stuff. One of the things that I love in Dubai is that you have very much that same feeling that you get if you're in LA or New York or any of these real business hubs in the United States. If another country really wanted to dominate, they would say, all Americans are welcome. We'll give you citizenship. Just come here and start your businesses. And all of that innovation and all of that can-do attitude, if a country would just give Americans the platform, I know so many that would move there in a heartbeat and take that citizenship.
And then renounce U.S. citizenship?
In a heartbeat.
Yeah. You know, it's really sad, but I've heard over the years more and more of a statement sort of like this: in order to live the American dream, I have to renounce U.S. citizenship.
That's a very true statement.
Well, it's very sad. It's very sad. I mean, regardless of your attitude towards globalization, it is happening. Okay. You know, plainly and simply, you know, the world is becoming more interconnected, et cetera. And the U.S. tax and regulatory regime operates to essentially create impediments to U.S. citizens participating in that world.
And, you know, I read a really interesting article in Time magazine yesterday that was talking about the brain drain in the U.S., right? Because of the immigration policy, you know, a lot of foreign students that used to come to the U.S., very intelligent ones and would stay, are now, you know, going to universities in other countries because of the sort of remote work that has been allowed through COVID and which will likely remain. So many people, including Americans, are now moving abroad. So many countries have opened up like digital nomad visas that are relatively cost effective where you can live tax free. And the U.S. is isolating itself, right? Not only does it have its brightest and wealthiest leaving, right? But they're kind of putting up blockades from letting new ones come in.
Yeah. There's no question. It's unfortunate that, and this is why, you know, why not only should Americans abroad be treated as having their own state, but why they would be incredibly important participants in the operation of U.S. government and policy, because it would give them, you know, it would provide a window, you know, to what's happening outside the United States, right?
It's a very good point. One that I hadn't thought of, but a very good point.
Well, this has been another great discussion. Let me read in again, lesson 10, as we come to an end here. It's always interesting how, you know, you read these things and what do they mean? And then we get started talking and we just see example after example, right? But here it is. Lesson 10, tax exemptions are inherently unjust unless they actually apply to everyone. If the constitutional principle of equality before the law is ever applied to taxation, then those in control of tax making must bear the same tax as those on the outside. This means that in aristocracy or oligarchy, the few would have to bear the same tax as the many. And in a democracy, the many should bear the same taxes as the few. Truer words were never spoken.
Amen.
Well, Jimmy, this has been great. How do people get a hold of you if they want enhanced Jimmy Sexton wisdom before next Monday?
But before the price goes up to 12.5 million a client.
Well, and we have our next meeting.
Yes, exactly. EsquireGroup.com or shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com.
And I'm John Richardson at CitizenshipSolutions.ca. Great, great talk, Jimmy. I'm now pumped off to another great start to the week. Thank you so much. Sure.